Welcome to the Voice of Family Business on Capitol Hill. It's great to have you with us. With each podcast from Family Enterprise USA, we bring you the latest news, expert opinions, and insights affecting the country's largest employer, the American family business. If you like this series, please remember to subscribe and sign up for the alerts as future shows are posted wherever you download your podcasts. In this episode, we bring you a lively and in-depth discussion with our hosts Pat Soldano and Matt Brown, partner at the Irvine, California-based law firm Brown & Strezza. Today, they will discuss the ramifications of the possible expiration of the tax provisions in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, including the $13 million estate, gift, and GST lifetime exemption and other tax provisions, and how this will affect family offices and family businesses that may or may not be planning for it. They also discuss important tax cases and the Corporate Transparency Act.
So welcome to today's podcast. I'm Pat Soldano, president of Family Enterprise USA and Policy and Taxation Group. If you don't know who we are, we advocate for generationally owned family businesses and their lifetime of savings at a national level in Washington, D.C., all sizes of business, small, medium, and large, and all industries. So today we're here with Matt Brown, who is the partner in the law firm of Brown & Strezza, which is based in Irvine, California. Matt heads up the firm's tax, trust, and estates group and its ultra high net worth subgroup. The firm serves families, family businesses, entrepreneurs, investors, philanthropists, and charitable organizations through its integrated approach to business and personal planning. So today we're going to speak to Matt about the potential dire ramifications of the expiration of what's called TCJA, or the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which most people know was signed back in 2017. It includes a $13 million plus exemption for gift estate and generation skipping taxes and other provisions. And so we want to know how this will affect family offices and family businesses and successful individuals in this country who may be planning or not planning for this tax. As you may or may not be aware, many of the provisions of TCJA will be expiring at the end of December 2025. So there's also some important tax cases that Matt's going to talk to us about. And I think those are going to be very, very helpful in the planning process as well. So, Matt, it's great to have you here today. And we'll walk through these complex different issues as well as scenarios.
Great. Well, thanks, Pat. It's great to be here with you.
So let's start with why I wanted to have an estate attorney, and Matt and I have known each other for quite some time, on this podcast, because I really want to talk about how family offices and family businesses can do their planning with what I just talked about, with the exemption that is going to expire and roll back to, you know, maybe $5-8 million. So let's talk at the 30,000 foot level first, Matt, and some of your views on those provisions that are expiring, not just maybe the estate tax, but some other like income tax, capital gains. We'll get into the specifics of each tax, but why don't you just give us your overview of those provisions that are expiring?
Sure. So as a trust and estate attorney, the one that gets the attention of most people is, right now we have an estate tax exemption or estate and gift tax exemption of $13,610,000 per person. So that's about $27 million per couple. And that's heading to maybe around $14 million next year in 2025. You double that, you get to about $28 million per couple. And then when we get to 2026, it's cut roughly in half from that point forward. And so trying to use that exemption while it exists is one key item. Another is the qualified business income deduction. So the corporate rate will continue to be at 21%, but the qualified business income deduction, which is designed to help pass through entity owners get closer to the 21% rate that applies to C corporations, will expire at the end of 2025. The SALT cap also goes away. So a lot of taxpayers may be happy about that if that continues to stay away, because that would eliminate the limitations on state and local income tax deductions, including property tax. There's some changes in the mortgage interest deduction cap that it would actually increase from the current $750,000 to $1 million of mortgage balance, and the ability to deduct interest on home equity loans would be increased or would come back into an existence at $100,000. And then finally, there are a few changes to bonus depreciation. It's dwindling slowly. Right now, you can still use it for used property instead of new, but the percentage deduction is dwindling as we get closer to 2026.
Well, so that's very helpful. And that's a lot of provisions. But let's drill down into the gift estate and generation skipping tax provision, as you just talked about, which is over $13 million per person, $27 million per couple. It could roll back to $8 million. It could roll back to even less than that. But that will have a substantial impact on families that are planning, that have family businesses or family offices. What kind of advice are you giving them in terms of the planning and the giving that they should be doing?
Yeah, as far as the impact on them, what people sometimes miss in the estate planning world is the estate tax is imposed on the future value of your estate, including your business or other assets. So you have to consider future growth. So even if the exemption is larger than your current estate, it doesn't mean that will be the case in the future. Your estate will grow, the exemption could be reduced. And so you want to try to do whatever planning you realistically can, because most businesses cannot generate cash equal to 40% of their fair market value within 9 months of the date of the owner's death, or typically the surviving spouse in the case of a married couple. And so that's a lot of cash. You've just lost probably the founder or the key operator of the business, and you've got to raise all that cash. So there is a benefit out there right now. We have this bonus exemption where basically the estate tax exemption is doubled. And that's good through the end of next year. So some people who maybe procrastinated on planning now get to catch up on the lost benefits of not having planned earlier. And then others who are just coming around to doing this planning can take advantage of a larger exemption. As far as how we're advising clients in this space, one thing to consider is there's what I would call the top half and bottom half of the exemption. So if we round up and say the exemption is $14 million per person, just to make the math easier, if we assume $7 million is the permanent exemption, which is really a $5 million baseline, which has been inflation adjusted forward to be $7 million, and then the other $7 million, the top half, is our bonus exemption, you have to use all of the bottom half of the exemption to get up to the top half of the exemption. So if you were to gift, for example, exactly $7 million of value today, when the exemption is cut in half in 2026, it wouldn't you wouldn't have preserved any of this bonus exemption. You would have had to have gotten above the $7 million into the bonus category, the top half category, to be able to use that. So it's important, again, to remember that when you use the exemption at today's value, it's on today's value. And so if you were to move, let's say, $7 million or $14 million or whatever value into an irrevocable trust or down to a next generation family member, all of the growth that happens between the date of transfer and the date of your death happens free of estate taxes. So if that value starts at $7 or $14 million or more and grows to $20 million, $40 million, $50 million, $100 million, all of that future growth escapes estate tax. And in a properly structured trust, it can avoid estate tax and then another level tax called the generation skipping transfer tax that would apply when those assets transfer down to grandchildren. Other things I would say as far as the advice we're giving, though, for clients who have certain lifestyle needs or habits, expenditure habits, don't give away too much. If you impoverish yourself by giving away too much, you could actually have planning that you thought was great work against you, because the government can use creative arguments to say, look, you transferred so much, you effectively made yourself insolvent. There was an implied understanding you were going to get these assets back. So we're going to go ahead and use that implied understanding against you and try to include them in your estate. So don't get too excited about using every last penny of the exemption. The reality is the passage of time is the most powerful tool we have. And so if we use thoughtful planning today and get it done, and there's time between now and the time of death, then there's a lot of opportunity for value to increase in the interim. So I would tell a lot of people, try not to overdo it from that standpoint.
Well, you've made some really excellent points. And so I absolutely agree with you. I tell people that gifting early is the best kind of gifting to do. And I think your point about, you know, you may be under the threshold of the exemption today, but you've got to think about how your business or your assets are going to grow over time. And they may not be at some point, is also something that people forget about. And they think, I don't have to worry about this. But I also thought about your issue on insolvency, which quite frankly is amazing to me how that can work. First of all, you would be in a terrible place because you wouldn't have your assets. And then you've got the IRS coming after you wanting to include those assets back in your estate. So you've talked about the difficulty or some of the challenges with gifting. Why don't you talk more specifically about some of the tools that you can use once you get past kind of the psychological aspects of gifting, which is, you know, a topic in of itself, but let's talk about some of the specific tools that you use.
Sure. So when people are looking at wealth transfer, they oftentimes are concerned about the idea of loss of control. And I tend to lump control into two different categories. There's operational control or day-to-day business operation, and then there's personal consumption control or access to cash flow. And so from a planning standpoint, if somebody is looking at this exemption saying, I get it, I have to burn the bottom half to get to the top half, I'm just not comfortable transferring 14 million of value today because it would impact my lifestyle. Or what if I need it? I've talked to a lot of people, almost no matter what wealth they have generated, there is always that fear that they might need it for some sort of medical emergency or huge business setback or whatnot. And so out of those two types of control, allowing a client to retain operational control of the day-to-day affairs of the business is relatively straightforward. The tougher part is allowing them to retain cash flow control. And so I would say one planning option that's been very popular with such large exemptions that could be threatening to somebody who might otherwise want to use the exemption before it expires is transferring to an irrevocable trust for the benefit of a spouse. Sometimes these are called spousal life access trusts or SLATs. And so they have the benefit of burning, utilizing a significant part of the estate and gift tax exemption today. But then to the extent you want access to cash flow from those funds, you just have to be nice to your spouse. Now, that comes with a risk of death or divorce. If your spouse dies early or if the marriage ends, and keep in mind, not all marriages end because of a dislike of the other party. Sometimes one party loses capacity, they make bad decisions, they're manipulated into a divorce by somebody. So we do want to be careful that we haven't over-transferred in that instance as well. But we do have the ability to transfer assets to an irrevocable trust for the benefit of a spouse, such that there's, in some sense, at least some level of indirect access. The spouses could transfer them those assets into trust for the benefit of each other. So husband could create and fund a trust for the benefit of the wife. The wife could create and fund a trust for the benefit of the husband. In a sense, as an economic unit, they still have access to many of the same assets. They may have similar control, but that's where we have to use caution because there is something called the reciprocal trust doctrine that could allow the government to come in. And this happens upon one or both spouses' deaths, not today. So you won't know whether it was a problem for many decades in a lot of cases. The government could come in and unwind or attempt to unwind the transaction because they would say, look, it didn't cost you anything. It wasn't painful enough. You didn't really lose access to the assets because the parties were in largely the same economic situation before and after the transaction. And so there, those are all court-tested arguments, and there are taxpayers who've lost in court. So we have to be careful about how we structure those types of trusts. Sometimes we don't want assets coming back from one spouse to the other, or we want different assets moved in or different trustees. Certainly, we don't want to sign and fund trusts on the same day. So we have to make sure they're different enough not to be reciprocal. For clients who just will not or cannot get comfortable with gifting a sizable amount, you could do a smaller gift coupled with a sale in exchange for a promissory note, for example. The promissory note is an income stream. And so it makes those who are uncomfortable with large gifts more comfortable. But in addition, it provides an income stream coming back because the note has to be paid by the trust or the child to whom the business was sold. And that can be helpful for mitigating cash flow concerns, but also allow future growth in the value of the business to pass outside the reach of the estate tax.
So Matt, why don't you talk about some of the other estate tax strategies or tools that may be changing in the future?
So one of the tools, in fact, our favorite tool as an estate planning industry, is what we call a grantor trust. And that is the type of trust to which you would sell an appreciated asset, like an operating business, for example. So in the just a few moments ago, I had mentioned the idea of selling an asset to a trust in exchange for a promissory note. What some people may wonder is, well, wait a minute, if I sell my business to a trust for a promissory note, don't I have to pay income tax? And the answer is no, if it's a grantor trust, because it's an irrevocable trust that is not the taxpayer for income tax, or excuse me, for estate and gift tax purposes, but is the taxpayer for income tax purposes. It's as though for income tax purposes, you sold the family business from your left pocket to your right pocket. That's not an income taxable event, but it is in a different wrapper or a different container. In this case, the new container is an irrevocable trust. And so you can sell to that trust free of income tax, but perhaps the even bigger magical piece is the fact that as the family business that is now owned by this trust not only grows over time, but also generates taxable income, that taxable income generates income tax that has to be paid by the senior generation, the taxpayer who gifted and or sold the family business to the trust. Now, that sounds like a terrible financial result because it puts a very big cash flow burden on the senior generation. But if they're trying to otherwise reduce their estate, it can be very, very powerful, especially over a long period of time. We tend to call that tax burn. And the reason I bring that up here is because that is one of the areas of tax law that we have found very useful for quite some time that is potentially on the chopping block based on certain proposed legislation. There's nothing pending right now that would deal with that issue. There has been some pressure on the IRS to unilaterally issue regulations to deal with that issue. I don't think that will happen because it's got such a long history of case law. There are other issues such as reduction of valuation discounts. The IRS doesn't like valuation discounts. They don't want people to be able to take those. But the reality is those do apply to operating businesses. And the question is whether any legislation or IRS regulations that might come out on those would account for the fact that an operating business is different from, for example, a partnership merely holding securities. There may be a tax on what are called defined value clauses, and not so much a tax. The government already doesn't like those, but they've lost a whole string of cases. But they may attempt to legislate or regulate against those. And those are basically clauses where instead of having to worry about whether the valuation expert was right on a value, we can simply say, I'm transferring $14 million worth of LLC interests, whatever number of LLC interests that is. Now we know we transferred $14 million. If the business turns out to be worth $20 million, $30 million, or some other number, we're only transferring $14 million worth, and we don't have a tax surprise. The government doesn't like that. They want the taxpayers to have more skin in the game because it makes it easier for the government to get revenue. A couple of other items that have been proposed as recently as the 2025 Green Book, President Biden's budget or proposed budget, would be the concept of gain recognition upon death. So not only would we not get a basis step up upon death, we'd have gain recognized. And on top of that, there would be an estate tax. If certain statutes were actually combined together without offsetting credits, you could face up to 105% tax liability upon death. So those are sort of scary numbers. Hopefully not all of those proposals pass at some point in the future. And then there are a couple of other proposed changes on grants or grant or retained annuity trusts, requiring a minimum term and a minimum gift size, and a few other technical details there that make those techniques slightly less advantageous. And then finally, just the looming possibility of a wealth tax. I'm in California, where we do not have an inheritance tax. It's constitutionally prohibited, which might surprise people from outside California. But there have been a number of proposals to implement a wealth tax in California, an annualized tax on accumulated wealth or unrealized gain. And of course, there have been federal proposals to do the same thing. And so those are some issues to keep an eye out for.
Well, those are all very, very important. I'm so glad that you talked about some of the things in President Biden's Green Book, and certainly grantor trusts were very scary, fought back a lot when it was in Build Back Better and when they were discussing elimination of grantor trusts, valuation discounts. The intel that we're gathering from the Treasury is they're not going to touch that, but you and I both know that can change at any time, so families need to focus on that, as well as all the other things that you mentioned, including the wealth tax, which I agree with you, is very scary. It seems more possible than it's ever been. So we need to pay attention to that. So let's turn to all these provisions that are possible and what you're hearing from your prospective clients and clients in terms of their interest in planning for the expiration of the provisions in TCJA. Are you getting more interest? I mean, I've been telling families they need to be planning as quickly as possible because all the estate attorneys are going to be too busy. What are you hearing?
We knew it would be incredibly busy for this year, for 2024 and for 2025. And so for the last several years, I've been telling clients, please, if you're going to do something, please do it in 2024. I want to be able to have the time to be thoughtful and really customize what we're working on. I don't want to be in a rush, and I guarantee you 2025 will be a rush, and it'll be more like, hey, kind of make a quick decision. Let's get off to the races. Let's execute. It'll be very, very difficult to customize. And so, yes, people should really get started. We've already heard from appraisers, evaluation experts who are turning clients away or who are at capacity for at least the rest of this year and possibly into next year. We went through something similar in 2020 and 2021. In 2020, it was related to the presidential election and the concerns over what President Biden might or might not propose. In 2021, it was based on the fact that we had a couple of runoff elections in Georgia that turned out differently than people assumed. And it became a very real possibility of significant legislative changes, not just on the estate and gift tax side, but also on the income tax side. And effectively, people were engaged in panic planning in both of those years. In 2020, we wound up having to cut off new work in September. When we got to 2021, we had to cut off new work for the entire year, April 4th, which was very difficult to do. I did not enjoy those conversations. We're trying to do it a little differently this time because we had a little more notice. We're trying to communicate very clearly with people who maybe have been procrastinating that they can't do it indefinitely. We are trying to preserve a little bit of margin for those clients who just didn't realize this was an issue for them until closer to last minute, to hopefully be able to jump in and help them. But it will be very, very difficult. I referred a lot of work to other lawyers in 2020 and 2021. I had several of them call me and ask that I stop referring work because they couldn't handle it. And the volume of just prospect calls was overwhelming to them. So it's going to be crazy. There's a very steep learning curve to learn this stuff. You cannot staff up sufficiently to deal with the temporary increase in demand.
Well, that's so helpful for families to know, and so important. And I've heard that from others. So let's talk about one of the provisions that is dramatically going to affect family business owners. As we have learned through our survey every year, 80% of family business owners operate as a pass-through entity. So that's a, you know, S-Corp, LLC, LP. And 199A, which gives them that 20% deduction against their income, is expiring in the TCJA. So as we know, that legislation was passed to help kind of equalize the 21% that corporations pay against the 37% that pass-through entities pay. It doesn't get them equal by any stretch, but it brings them closer together. And now we see that provision expiring. So maybe you can talk to us a little bit about how you can help families, family businesses, help on that side of the equation in terms of the income tax mitigation.
Sure. When TCJA first passed, we had a number of clients who wanted to look at whether it made sense to convert from an S corporation to a C corporation. Because with a C corporation, it's two levels of tax, which historically has been disadvantageous or viewed as disadvantageous. But corporate rates were now at 21%. They were much lower than individual rates in some cases. Now, if you had this qualified business income deduction that got you closer for a pass through to 21%, it was maybe somewhat of a push on whether you really should become a C corporation or an S corporation was just as good or close to as good. If you think about a corporation with a 21% rate, and then the dividends coming out of that corporation having a 20% rate, you wind up with a blended rate of about 36.8%. So pretty close to the individual maximum rate of 37%. At least currently, that is slated to go up to 39.6% in 2026. But you can, with a corporate rate of 21% and a long-term capital gains rate of 20%, you can get pretty close to that 37% rate. And so it starts to maybe make sense for people to consider C corporations. One of the things that makes a C corporation particularly advantageous is if somebody's in a business that is rapidly growing or that they want to rapidly grow. And the reason for that is the cost of capital comes down considerably because you only have the 21% federal rate at the corporate level. You don't have to push dividends out to the shareholders. And so you can accumulate and deploy cash much more quickly for a rapid expansion. But on the other hand, whether you should be a C corporation deals with other issues. There are very positive aspects of C corporations. For example, in the tech startup space, it's fairly common to use or to create what's called a qualified small business stock or 1202 stock, which allows each taxpayer, each shareholder, to exclude up to $10 million of taxable gain from their sales proceeds. That can sometimes be multiplied across multiple irrevocable trusts to get, you know, instead of a $10 million gain exclusion, maybe a $20, $30, $40 million gain exclusion. We've got some barriers with respect to the estate or the gift tax as far as how much can get into a trust that we have to consider. But there are a number of ways to increase that gain exclusion. That's only federal. Some states like California do not conform to that gain exclusion, but that can be one benefit of a C corporation. One of the detriments of a C corporation is buying appreciating real estate or having a closely held business that grows tremendously in value, and now you want to sell to a third party. Typically, the third parties want to buy assets of the corporation. They do not want to buy corporate stock. Now you're in a double taxation situation where the sales proceeds are subject to those two levels of tax. Whereas had you been able to sell in an S corp situation or an LLC or a partnership, you'd only have one level of tax and it would be a 20% long-term capital gain tax. So you've effectively opted into at least a 36.8% combined tax cost by having double taxation upon sale, when you could have had just a 20% long-term capital gain tax upon sale. I'll just qualify that with the fact that in most of those cases, you'll also have the 3.8% Obamacare surtax, or the 1411 net investment income tax is the more technical term, but a lot of people still know that as the Obamacare surtax.
So you touched on capital gains, and I want to get to these cases that have been, the decisions have been made on by the Supreme Court, but I want to talk briefly about capital gains. And maybe you've talked a little bit about some of the planning that can be done, but maybe you could expand on that briefly.
Sure. One of the things in President Biden's 2025 Green Book is that there'd be no preferential capital gain rate if you had over $1 million of income. So now capital gain is taxed effectively the same as ordinary income, which right now is a top rate of 37%. And so when you start looking at the possibility of capital gains rates going up, how do you adjust your planning? One thing to consider is, what are the years potentially at risk? When might this happen? It's unlikely to happen right now based on the current government makeup, but could it happen as early? Could it happen before some of the current tax provisions expire? That's possible, depending on the makeup, because sometimes laws are passed retroactively, usually not more than the current year in which they're passed. But you want to consider what year the exposure is potentially applicable. Another consideration is to just delay loss harvesting. So if you have some loss positions in stocks or other assets, maybe delay those until we're in a year where maybe the tax is higher. Now, we're not there yet. So this is just more on a just-in-case basis. We don't have any certainty that capital gains are going higher. Maybe defer charitable deductions and then offset income at a higher, an otherwise higher tax rate. As far as people who know or are nearly certain that they're going into a higher tax environment from the standpoint of capital gains rates going up, either going up across the board or going up based on this $1 million plus income threshold. One thing we have done in the past when we were facing economic periods like this or tax change periods like this, we would actually sell some of those appreciated assets to what's called a non-grantor trust. It's just a term for a trust taxed as a separate income taxpayer, and sell that in exchange for a promissory note. And then you elect out of installment sale treatment. What does that do? It keeps the asset within the family, but it triggers gain recognition in the current year when the capital gain rate is, as now, 20%, for example, allowing the family to trigger gain recognition now as opposed to triggering gain recognition in a year when perhaps the gain recognition is at 37% or even 39.6% once we get past 2025 into 2026 and beyond. So that's not a foregone conclusion. Those are just potential things that could happen, but people need to pay attention to it. One other thing I'll briefly note is the IRS has recently issued a revenue ruling and has promised some regulations related to something that's called basis stripping, which is where Wealthy investors will sometimes move basis among various partnerships to minimize tax on current liquidity events and defer that tax downstream. The government has come out very, very aggressively with some guidance on that, and we can expect to see a lot more guidance there as well.
That's fascinating. Well, so let's talk about some of these cases, and hopefully we'll be able to get through them. So the Moore case was most recently decided just last week on June 20th by the Supreme Court. Five judges that ruled against the plaintiff, two dissented. And the case, which I know you're going to explain to us, really ruled that, you know, taxing realized gains that were not distributed is being upheld, which was the ruling of the lower court. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about the ramifications, the ruling itself, and then the ramifications of the ruling?
Sure. It's a bit of a complicated tax area, but it was related to what's called the mandatory repatriation tax, or MRT for short. And it was a couple who were effectively being taxed on income that was not the cash flow from which was not received by them. It was in an offshore corporation. And in fact, they were even being taxed on income that had been realized in years when they didn't even own a share of the offshore corporation. In this case, the issues in front of the court were very, very significantly narrowed. So it's a little bit difficult to get a clear takeaway. But what appears to be the takeaway is it appears the court believes there is a realization event required in order to tax income. What that means is it has to be either actual realization, meaning the taxpayer receives cash, or it has to be constructive realization, which maybe the easiest way to think about that is if you buy a zero coupon bond, there are what are called original issue discount rules that purport to tax you, or that do tax you, on the imputed income each year that would have otherwise been payable on interest if it were a bond that was paying based on coupons. Pass-through taxation or flow-through taxation for partnerships and S corporations, it's routine for people to pay tax, or taxpayers to pay tax on that income, even if they don't necessarily receive it. And so if you, the what appears to be the issue is really that the Supreme Court didn't quite directly address what the Ninth Circuit appeared to have concluded, which was, look, we don't need a realization event to be able to tax. And the Supreme Court says, well, yes, you do need a realization event, but we're willing to go so far as to say it could be a constructive realization event. I don't think that this mandatory repatriation tax really does fit within either realization or constructive realization, because they're taxing them on income arguably attributable to other people, for example. But what's helpful from the case is even the Solicitor General representing the United States agreed that under the 16th Amendment, apportionment among the states would be required if there was no realization. So the argument there was, okay, hypothetically, we think maybe we could tax without a realization or a constructive realization event, but we are acknowledging that the 16th Amendment of the Constitution requires us to apportion. Well, what that means is the government would look at that as though it would be an incredibly inconvenient solution or outcome. And so that makes them far less likely to propose a wealth tax. That's the hope of taxpayers, is that effectively this case does not shut down the possibility of a wealth tax, but it triggers or signals to Congress, hey, you know, you can try to pass a wealth tax, but there's a pretty high probability you'll be wasting your time if you do it, because it's unlikely to have that even constructive realization that would allow the court to uphold it.
Well, so my final question to you, I don't think we're going to get to all these court cases, is really revolves around the Conley case. And this was where there was a buy-sell agreement, and it was unanimously decided by the Supreme Court that the proceeds or that the value of the life insurance policy be included in the value of the business. And so maybe you can walk us through that decision and the ramifications of that decision.
So Connolly was dealing with what's called a corporate redemption buy-sell agreement. So in that instance, and it doesn't have to be just a corporation, but it could be any sort of business entity. But in that case, you have more than one owner, and you're worried about owners or partners being able to buy each other out upon the death of one of the partners. And so they will all have life insurance policies taken out on their lives. The corporation or the business entity will own the life insurance policy and will receive the death benefit. And then it will redeem the estate of the deceased shareholder. So there's a code section 2042 that deals with estate inclusion of life insurance. And because of some of the difficulties of administering it, it used to be the case for a very short time, and then the government withdrew the guidance, where you could be in a situation where the taxpayer's estate would actually wind up including, subject to estate tax, these life insurance proceeds, and basically overpaying estate tax on assets that were then used to buy the estate out for the stock. So the default rule or the rule was changed such that to avoid that result of including the death benefit in the estate, we just include it in the corporation or in the entity, and now it has to increase the value of the entity. So the only question before the court was, is the redemption obligation, the obligation of the corporation to redeem out the surviving shareholder, is that an offset to value, to offset the increase in value that came from that life insurance policy? And the answer is no. And they were overruling prior precedent from courts of appeal, but it's really a rather sensible result, all things considered. When you consider why the death benefit increases the value of the corporation, it also makes sense that the redemption would not be a deduction. But this does suggest that people who have set up buy-sell agreements under a corporate redemption structure need to revisit those, because it's no longer as tax advantageous as it once was. Now, maybe something like a cross purchase where the individual owners hold life insurance policies on each other might make more sense. Those are harder to administer. Now you have to monitor, do my partners still have this life policy? Are they paying the premiums? Am I paying the premiums? Is it in the right kind of trust? And so there could be some significant restructuring needed as part of these various buy-sell agreements.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating and also very, very valuable information for family businesses and others, quite frankly, who use life insurance for estate planning purposes. So, Matt, this has been a wonderful conversation, incredible amount of information for all of our listeners today. Really, really appreciate your time and all the work that you put in to prepare for this podcast. Again, excellent information. So thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Well, thanks, Pat. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Absolutely. So we hope you liked today's show. And if you did, please subscribe to our podcast, where each episode discusses the critical issues affecting generationally owned family businesses and their lifetimes of savings, as well as successful individuals and family offices around the country. You can find this podcast wherever you download your podcast. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this week's Family Enterprise USA podcast. This is the only series devoted exclusively to the critical issues facing America's family businesses, the families that own them, and the clients of family offices. We hope you liked this episode. Please make sure to subscribe and tell others about our podcast. Having your voice heard in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country can make a difference. We look forward to having you listen in next time.